So we're going to have our first normal day today, which is an actual lecture and some laboratory stuff to do in this scientific fundamental slideshow. I can skip past slide one because I've already introduced myself last time. In slide two, I want to talk briefly about the difference between science and religion, because they are fundamentally different. Religion's based on faith, not on evidence. Faith refers to believing something even though there isn't evidence. That's why it's called faith. If you're faithful, you don't have to be shown evidence. Science, on the other hand, is evidence-based. And therefore, what we say is true as humans, that's only true to the extent that there's evidence. And sometimes, when we look closer, that evidence changes. And therefore, what we used to say is true is no longer true. Right? For instance, obvious example, we said for a while the earth is flat. Once we figured out that it wasn't, we no longer say that's the truth. Evidence is required for scientific truth. And so this is a science class, obviously. I'm not going to get into the philosophy of this, but that's a fundamental difference, because science is always evolving as we learn more and more. Okay, now that's science in general. In slide three, we're talking about three branches of science: chemistry, biology, and biotechnology. We already briefly talked about biotechnology. Well, not even so briefly. We talked about biotechnology, gave a different definition of that last time. But today we're going to talk about chemistry and biology. And what is chemistry? Anyone want to give a definition of that? It's not so easy when you think about it, right? Chemistry is a huge branch of science, and chemistry itself can be broken down into other huge branches. But chemistry is the science that deals with changes in substances, among other things. That's actually not all of chemistry even, but chemistry deals with the nature of substances and changes in those substances. So those changes in substances occur in what we call chemical reactions, which is a big part of chemistry. So we'll talk about some chemical reactions in a minute. But chemistry, a knowledge of chemistry requires a knowledge of how material things are built. There are material things and non-material things. Material things are made out of matter. And so we're going to be talking about what atoms are and what atoms are made out of and what atoms combined with other atoms can form. It's a little bit of what we'll talk about today. Biology is the science of life, the science of living things. That's what bio means. And so it's a huge branch of science as well that can be broken down into still huge subfields, but that's simply because there are a lot of living things on Earth, and they exhibit huge diversity, and you can study things at many different levels. So no one is an expert in all of biology. You know, that used to be the case a couple hundred years ago. Now, just like all science, it's very specialized. You know, so you have people that are concerned only at the molecular level, people who only care about ecosystems, and so on. That's all within biology. Let's go to slide four. And here is a chemical reaction, like I was talking about. A chemical reaction can be written different ways. This one's written with pictures. But any chemical reaction has one or more substances that are called reactants, and those reactants get changed into different stuff. One or more products are the things that those reactants get changed into. For it to be a chemical reaction, you end up with different stuff than you had to begin with. That's distinct, for instance, from evaporation of water. When water evaporates, you start with water in liquid form, you end up with water in gaseous form, water vapor, or steam, but that's still water. It's still the same stuff. It's just in a different state. In a chemical reaction, you actually change the stuff you have. And this is a good example to show you how drastically a change can be made. In this chemical reaction, you can tell the reactants from the product. In this case, there's only one product, two reactants. But you can tell where the reactants end and the products start by this arrow, which is kind of like an equal sign in an equation. You have the left side and you have the right side. The left side are the reactants, the right side includes the products, however many there are. Okay, now, sodium and chlorine are both elements. Elements are pure substances, and all of the elements are listed on the periodic table you see on the wall here. Sodium happens to be a metal. Periodic table lists all the elements, but the elements can be roughly broken down into the metals, which are on the left side, and actually more than half. Most of the elements are metals. And then everything to the right of this diagonal kind of red stair-step line are nonmetals. Chlorine is a nonmetal, Cl. Notice it's up there in the upper right, whereas sodium is way on the left, the first column. Well, anyway, sodium is not just a metal. It's a highly reactive metal, meaning that it will react violently with water, for instance, which is why it's dangerous stuff. You would never want to handle pure sodium, because just touching your skin will react with the moisture in your skin and burn the hell out of you. So you don't want to have any part of handling sodium, which is why this dude's wearing gloves. Chlorine, in its natural state, is a gas. You see a yellowish-green gas. And it's poisonous. So just like sodium, you don't want chlorine around you at all. It'll do you harm. But if you get the two together, these two harmful things, they will react with each other to make sodium chloride, which is table salt. Sodium chloride is not only not toxic to you, it's absolutely essential. You have to have sodium chloride because your brain, your entire nervous system, your entire muscular system, actually all of your cells require this compound. All right? So because of chemistry, because of a chemical reaction, two very dangerous things are turned into something that's not dangerous. The products, in other words, in a chemical reaction differ substantially, in most cases, from the reactants in their properties. Okay, let's look at slide 5 and talk about the nature of particles. Material things are made out of particles. That's true for anything that we call a material item. So all of you, all the non-living stuff around you, made out of particles of different sizes. Well, the fundamental particle, as far as elements are concerned, is the atom. But atoms themselves are made out of even smaller particles. And we'll talk about those smaller particles. But one atom is shown in this slide. Atoms are inconceivably tiny things. It takes a ridiculously huge number of atoms collected together just to make something that's barely visible to your eye. So they are truly, truly tiny objects. But that's what all material stuff is made out of in the universe. Okay? The periodic table lists elements which are different from each other, not because they're made of, well, I mean, they're made of different types of atoms. The elements are made out of different types of atoms. But the only reason that there are different types of atoms is because the different types of atoms differ in the numbers of the smaller particles those atoms are made out of. Now, the smaller particles that atoms are made out of are collectively called subatomic particles. Sub means below. So subatomic means even smaller than the atom. And there are three primary types of subatomic particles, all of which are shown here. The three types of particles are neutrons, protons, and electrons. Now, the neutrons here are brown, the protons are magenta, and the electrons are yellow. Notice that the overall atom is broken into two regions. The central region is called the nucleus, the atomic nucleus. And that's a completely different use of the word from what we'll talk about later as a cell nucleus. A cell nucleus is huge compared to this atomic nucleus. But the nucleus, in general, that word just means the core, the kernel. So that's the center of an atom. And only two, you find only two of those kinds of subatomic particles in the nucleus. The nucleus always contains at least one proton. It depends on what kind of element we're talking about. It contains one or more protons. And most atoms also contain neutrons, although neutrons aren't absolutely required. If there are neutrons, though, you find them in the nucleus only, just like the protons. So the nucleus is made up only of protons and neutrons, however many there are for that type of atom. And as the cartoon kind of makes obvious, neutrons and protons are almost exactly the same size. Now, there's a special word in science that we give to the amount of matter that an object contains. What is that word? That is mass. Mass refers to the amount of matter that an object contains. And so when we say that something is massive, if we're using that word scientifically, that means it has a lot of mass. There's a lot of matter in that object. All right? Well, protons and neutrons have almost exactly the same mass. Not identical, but practically identical. You have to go out into the fourth decimal place or something before there's a difference. But they are drastically different in another respect. Protons are charged particles, electrically charged. They have an electrical charge to them, which is why there's a plus in the middle of each one in this cartoon. Whereas neutrons don't have any charge. That's why they're called neutrons. They're neutral. All right? So the nucleus overall has a positive charge because it contains protons. Even if it contains only one, it still is positively charged. The neutrons don't contribute to the charge. All right, now electrons are not found in the nucleus. They are found at some distance from the nucleus. And we don't actually know at any given moment where they are. We just can calculate probabilities. We know where they are more likely to be than other places but we never know exactly where they are at any given moment. This cartoon shows that they are circling in a nice, perfect circular orbit around the nucleus. That's not actually the truth, but it's okay to think of it that way. It's a good cartoon of what's really happening. So electrons are found circling nuclei, or not. I shouldn't even say circling. They're moving around the nucleus in some path. Electrons are always moving. Now, one thing that this cartoon does not show you very well, two things actually, are that electrons are much, much tinier than protons and neutrons. This shows it a little smaller. It's much more drastically smaller, really. Protons and neutrons are already ridiculously small, but electrons are much tinier even still. The second thing is that they're really much farther away from the nucleus as well. But this is just drawn conveniently so you can see the stuff. Now notice that these electrons have negative signs in them. And that's because electrons are also electrically charged, just like protons are. Importantly, even though electrons are much tinier than protons, the negative charge that an electron has is just as big, exactly as big, as the positive charge that a proton has. So they're drastically different sizes, but they have equal size charges, and they're opposite charges, because one is negative, one is positive. And therefore, since they're equal in size, if you have the same number of electrons as you have protons in the nucleus, then they counteract each other, and the sum of all those charges, when you add them up, is zero. In this case, you have negative 2 and positive 2. You add those together, you get zero charge. So an atom, overall, is not charged. It's a neutral particle. But it's made up of charged particles. Right? Let's look at another chemical reaction, slide 6. Notice that these chemical reactions are also, well, the top one is also not written in words. It's using cartoons. But it still has an arrow. Chemical reactions will always feature an arrow separating reactants from products. This is the same reaction written two different ways. And the top is cartoons of what the actual atoms are doing, and the bottom are chemical formulae for the materials that are involved. So I've mentioned elements, but I haven't really told you what an element is specifically. Or maybe I have. I'm going to tell you again if I have. An element is a substance that's made up of only one kind of atom. So if you have a chunk of stuff, let's say it's iron. If it's pure iron, and if you were able to get in there and look at the atoms that it's made out of, which if you had a chunk of it, there would be an enormous number of atoms there. Every one of those atoms would be iron atoms. And what makes an iron atom an iron atom rather than any of the other kinds of atoms, any of the other kinds of elements, is its number of protons. So when you look at this periodic table, notice that each symbol, which represents an element, in its box, in the lower left of the box, has a number. A red number in this case of this periodic table. And those numbers are in order. So it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. That number is called the atomic number. And what it actually means, what it points out, is the number of protons that that kind of atom has. So I've said a couple times that there are different kinds of atoms that make up the different kinds of elements. But all electrons, protons, and neutrons are the same. Therefore, the only reason atoms differ from one type to another is in how many of those things they have. But of those three subatomic particles, it's only protons that matter when you're trying to figure out what kind of atom it is. All right? So the simplest atom is one that has the bare minimum number of protons, which is one, and that's a hydrogen atom, H. Simplest element in the universe. If you have another proton in there with it, two protons total in the nucleus, then you have helium, upper right, and then lithium, beryllium, and so on. Okay? So that's the only thing that matters to the type of element, is the number of protons. Now, if your atoms are regular neutral atoms, the only way they can be neutral is if you have the same number of electrons as protons, same number of negatives as positives. So if you're talking about a lithium atom, for instance, which is another metal, lithium is number 3, therefore it has 3 protons. That's what makes it lithium. But for it to be a neutral atom of lithium, it also has to have 3 electrons. All right? Well, those are elements. An element is made up of only one kind of atom. There are other kinds of substances besides elements, though. When you have 2 or more different elements, in other words, 2 or more different kinds of atoms, combine, hook together, you form something called a compound. To compound means to add together, right? So compounds are substances that are not pure. You don't find compounds on the periodic table because this is the periodic table of elements. Compounds are made out of elements, though. All right? Well, here you have in this example chemical reaction 2 elements as reactants. Reactants don't have to be elements. They just are in this example. You have hydrogen gas and oxygen gas. Each one is a pure element. And when they react, notice that the hydrogens and the oxygen atoms get recombined. And what you make are water molecules. You probably already know that water is H2O. It's called H2O. Its chemical formula is H2O because each particle of water has 2 hydrogens, the 2 whites, hooked to 1 oxygen. When there's only 1, we don't bother to write a 1. Otherwise, it would be H2O1. All right, so that's why it is H2O. And once again, in this chemical reaction, you end up with stuff that's totally different from the stuff you start with. All right, but water is a compound, not an element, because water is made out of 2 or more elements, in this case exactly 2. Okay, slide 7. These are elements, this table lists elements that occur in the human body, and the elements that occur naturally and the few that we are able to produce in the laboratory, but those few that we produce in the laboratory only last a tiny fraction of a second, and those are really nothing, they have nothing to do with biology. That's only chemistry and physics that cares about that. These ones at the top, though, that you can find in nature, there's about 100 of those. Well, we don't include all of those. We're made out of mostly the small ones. Since the periodic table is ordered by the number of protons in each atom, that means as you go through the periodic table, reading left to right like sentences, the farther you get in the periodic table, the heavier, the bigger the atom is, the more massive it is, because it has more protons and neutrons. Okay? Well, we living things are made out of mostly the lighter stuff, which is all the stuff in the first few rows. By the way, on a periodic table, the rows are called periods, which is why it's called the periodic table. Periodic means that it repeats at regular intervals. Well, the properties of these different atoms repeats each row. The columns on the periodic table are called groups. Elements within the same group have similar properties. Lithium is similar to sodium, for instance. Okay, well, notice that we are made out of these 10 or so, mostly. Now on the bottom you see that we are made up of some slightly heavier ones, but those are in very, very small amounts in our body. We're mostly these 10 or so that are listed in the top two groups of this table. But even though we require all of these things, by far the bulk of our body, most of our stuff, is made out of just four kinds of atoms, four elements: oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, and hydrogen. Hydrogen is the smallest one, and as far as number is concerned, that's what most of our atoms are in our body. But they're the smallest ones, so they don't contribute nearly as much mass as the heavier ones. But oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, notice where they are. Number 6, 7, and 8. So pretty small also. These four molecules make up what we call organic compounds. And living things are made out of organic compounds. Okay, now let's go to slide 8. Here we have some properties of living things. Now we grow up gaining an understanding of what things are living and what things aren't. But if you ask a kindergartner to define a living thing, it's going to be a difficult task. Well, it's a difficult task as an adult, too. If I ask you to define what a living thing is, it's not easy to just put a nice, concise definition to. Instead, we usually define living things by listing several properties that all living things share. And that's what this slide lists. By the way, there is a word, organism, that does have a very specific definition. And it might not be the same thing as living thing. For instance, if I were to ask you if a virus is a living thing, probably some of you would say yes, probably some of you would say no. And it would make for a good argument, because there's a good... You could argue it either way and still be on solid ground. So whether you could call a virus living or not is up to you, really. One thing that it definitely is not, though, is an organism. To be an organism, which is a living thing, an organism must include at least one cell. Organisms are made out of cells. Well, if there are some organisms that are made out of just one cell, we call those unicellular organisms. We are examples of multicellular organisms. Highly multicellular. We're pretty huge compared to most organisms in the world. Anyone have any guess as to how many cells your own body contains? An average human, adult? Yeah.
Isn't it somewhere around 3 trillion?
Or even higher. 10 or more trillion, yes. But trillions. And trillions, easy to say, but it's hard to actually imagine how many a trillion is. You know, a trillion is a million million. A billion's a thousand million. A million itself is pretty huge. But to have a million of those, in other words, if you take just a millionth of your body, which is not a very big fraction, right? Just a tiny little scoop of yourself, one millionth of you, there's still a million cells in that tiny little scoop. So cells themselves are tiny from our point of view. Well, there are millions of atoms in a single cell. Many, many millions, billions actually, of atoms. All right? So, get an appreciation of how small that is. Anyway, for you to be an organism, you have to have at least one cell. So a bacterium, for instance, which is one-celled organism, is an organism. A virus isn't, though. A virus doesn't have a cell. It's a collection of molecules. It's tiny compared to a cell. But it's involved in life still. All right, anyway, these things are characteristics of organisms. Let's just go around clockwise, starting with response to the environment. Organisms can't live in isolation from the rest of the universe. They have to interact with the universe in order to live. And to live, what we really mean by living, or what we mean by life, is chemistry. Life really is just a bunch of chemical reactions, thousands of them, going on in each tiny little cell. That's what living is. When those chemical reactions stop, you no longer are alive. All right? But to have those chemical reactions proceed, you cannot be blocked off from the surroundings. And part of that is responding to the environment, like this carnivorous plant, a Venus flytrap or whatever species it is closing in response to this fly landing. It's going to digest this fly as a meal. Most plants make their food by photosynthesis, but some of them actually eat things like we do. So even a single-celled organism like a bacterium responds to the environment. If the chemistry, if the chemicals are different in the surroundings, the bacterium will behave differently. Living things reproduce. Living things are able to give rise to other living things. And that's because organisms, being made out of cells, can produce more cells. Cells come from pre-existing cells. They do that because cells are able to divide into two. When a cell divides into two, you now have two cells where you had one, and each of those can divide into two, so it keeps doubling every generation. Okay. Growth and development. Not only do overall organisms need to grow. For instance, you're all much bigger than you were when you started. You started as a single-celled zygote. That's what is created when a sperm and an egg fuse. That's a zygote. That's one cell. And that's how each of you started your life. Well, you're not just a huge cell now. You have gotten much bigger, but you've gotten bigger by adding a hell of a lot more cells. Not only that, though, you now are made out of cells of much different types. You're not just a blob of identical cells. You have cells that make up your lens of your eye, your kidney, and so on. So that's what development refers to, the changes along the way. But growth is increase in size. And even a single-celled organism grows to a certain point. Because if you consider one cell that splits into two, those two daughter cells, as they're called, are only roughly half as big as the original cell, which no longer exists, by the way. When it splits, it no longer exists. Right? So each of those daughter cells, before they can split, need to grow to the original size. So they can each split into two half-size cells themselves. So even unicellular organisms grow. But we grow not only because our cells get to the proper size, but we add more and more cells to make us multicellular. All right, energy processing. Cells are continuously processing energy, and that's because living is chemistry. Life is all those chemical reactions occurring in those tiny little test tubes called cells. Well, that requires a lot of processing of energy. And that's another reason we can't live in isolation. We have to have a continuous supply of materials coming in, and we need to continuously get rid of waste products that we produce in these cells. All right, regulation refers to keeping everything just the right way for these various chemical reactions we call life to occur. So a cell, even a single cell, but also a multicellular organism, needs a way to maintain conditions properly. And that brings up the definition of homeostasis. Now, stasis is the noun form of static, the adjective static. What does static mean? Static is the opposite of dynamic. Yes, static means staying the same. Dynamic means changing. And homeo also means same. So really, homeostasis is a redundant word etymologically. But homeostasis literally means staying the same. Homeostasis, as a scientific definition, would be the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. An internal environment means inside the organism. If it's a unicellular organism, it means inside that one cell. For us, it means not only inside our cells, but also in chambers in our body. All right? Homeostasis makes sure, I mean, if homeostasis is making sure that the various variables that could wander all over stay within pretty narrow ranges. So the easiest to understand, most familiar example would be temperature, which is one variable. We are animals that are examples of what we call endotherms, homeothermic endotherms. That homeothermic word means that we maintain a body temperature. Not all animals do this. Reptiles, for instance, don't. They basically take on whatever temperature it is outside, in their surroundings, the rock they're on, whatever. We, though, no matter what's happening around us, up within limits, keep a pretty constant body temperature. So when it's cold out, we're warm. When it's hotter than we are, we're cooler than the environment. We stay the same. Well, that maintenance of temperature is part of homeostasis. In fact, it's that little branch of homeostasis would be called thermostasis, maintenance of temperature. But we also need to maintain all kinds of other variables, like pH, for instance, the degree of acidity, how many times your heart beats. That's all part of homeostasis. And it involves regulation, that is, all living things are doing. Living things are also highly ordered, like this plant shows you. Non-living things usually don't show much order. You know, depends on the level you look at it. And there's some things that are highly ordered, like crystals. But, you know, an average rock that you look at is not nice and symmetrical. Organisms, though, show a high degree of order. And that order is expensive. Things don't just naturally become ordered. It takes energy, actually, to produce order. Just like it takes effort to maintain order in a room. If you don't put any effort into it, it slowly becomes more and more disordered. That's part of energy processing, by the way. Maintaining this order requires a lot of energy processing. And this final one is evolutionary adaptation. Now, adaptation is the noun form of adapt, and what does it mean to adapt? Not biologically, just in ordinary terms. What does it mean to adapt? To change, but change a certain way. To adapt means to adjust to the surroundings, to the conditions, right? And that's what biological adaptation is. Adaptation refers to how well fit an organism is to its surroundings. All right? If you have high fitness as an organism, that means you are doing just fine in under those conditions. Well, evolutionary adaptation means an increase in fitness because of evolution. And we could spend an entire semester just on evolution, especially because it's a highly misunderstood topic by non-scientists, unfortunately, because of various reasons. But evolution refers to change as well. Evolution doesn't occur within lifetimes of an individual. Evolution occurs between lifetimes. In other words, from generation to generation. And that's because when organisms reproduce, They don't necessarily make identical copies of themselves. Humans don't do that, right? The offspring of humans are different from the parents. Well, when you make these changes, and by the way, the reason that there are different kinds of organisms is because there are mistakes that are made in the DNA of organisms. And what do we call these mistakes? Anyone know?
Mutations,
yes. Mutations are just random accidents that occur. And that's why there are different versions of DNA, because accidents have happened. Usually accidents, since they're random, don't do you any good. So if you have a mutation occur, producing an individual that is called a mutant, chances are that mutant isn't going to do as well as the individuals that have the normal type of DNA, which means those mutant individuals will not have as high a chance of surviving long enough to be able to reproduce themselves. Well, when they reproduce, they pass on their DNA, which means a mutant reproducing would be passing on the mutant version. If the mutation is bad for you, though, you're not going to ever make it long enough to be able to reproduce, so that DNA version, that mutant version, doesn't get passed on. Every once in a while, though, just by accident, the mutant version of DNA gives you a slight advantage. It makes you even better. Increases your fitness. And therefore, those individuals, those mutants, actually have a higher chance of surviving and passing on their DNA. And therefore, each generation, you get a group of individuals that are more and more fit, more and more able to survive the conditions around them. That's why we have not just one kind of organism. We're not all bacteria. There are millions of different kinds of organisms because they've all taken these different evolutionary routes. Okay. Now let's go to slide 9 and talk about the hierarchy of biological organization. A hierarchy is a nested arrangement of things. So in a hierarchy, you have one group that includes several groups within it, and each of those groups then contains several groups, and so on. This is the hierarchy of biological organization, and I'm going to go through it from small to large. So I'm starting at the right side. Living things, organisms, are made out of... Well, they're material objects, living things, just like non-living things. And so they're made out of atoms. Like I said, everything that has matter is made out of atoms. And even though you can get smaller than atoms, you can look at subatomic particles, and then even those are made out of even smaller things. That's not biology, though. Physics cares about that. Atoms is as small as we care about in this class. Well, atoms of different kinds can get together to form larger collections called molecules. For instance, a tiny particle of water is a molecule. It's a molecule because it's made out of different atoms. Okay? Molecules of different kinds get together to form larger structures called organelles. Now, the word organelle literally means tiny organ. And that's because the organelles that an organism is made out of are like the little organs within a cell. So organelles are tiny. They are subcellular structures, meaning smaller than cells. Cells are made out of organelles. And that's why cell is the next level. Organelles of different types form larger structures called cells. And the cell level, that is the fundamental unit of life. Because in order to have all those 6 or 7 characteristics that were on that one slide, order, energy processing, all those things, in order to have all those properties, you have to have at least one cell. You have to be an organism. And so that the cell is the biological unit. Okay. Now, for some organisms, the cell I mean, for some organisms, these next couple levels don't exist. And those are the unicellular organisms, because for a unicellular organism, the cell is the entire organism. But for multicellular organisms, you have these levels in between cell and organism. In us, for instance. Cells of different types collect to form larger structures called tissues. For instance, muscle tissue in us. Tissues of different kinds collect to form larger structures called organs, like the leaf here. A leaf is an organ for the tree that owns it. Or an organ for you would be like the skin or the liver. Well, organs of different kinds collect into bigger organizations called organ systems. So what am I talking about in humans? What are some examples of organ systems? Respiratory system, digestive system, endocrine system. Those are different organs, but they are considered as an organ system because they work together for a common function. Right? All right, and then when you collect all the different organ systems in an organism together, they make the entire organism, like this tree or like a human. Different organisms, different kinds of organisms, so like a human and a tree. Different individuals of the same kind, of the same species. So a bunch of these same kind of trees, for instance, living together in one area would make up a population. So you have an oak population, you also have a population of certain squirrels and whatever. But wherever that population lives, chances are very good that they are not the only species living there. So when you include multiple populations, the human population, the squirrel population, and so on, then you have a community. The community includes only the living things, though. When you include the community, which is the living things, plus all the non-living things, the rocks and the water and whatever, in that same place, then that is an ecosystem. For instance, we live in a desert ecosystem. The desert includes not only all the living things that inhabit it, but all of the non-living things as well. And there are different ecosystems. When you combine all the ecosystems on Earth, all the places where you find living things, you have the biosphere, which is not the Earth itself. The biosphere is a hollow shell, spherical shell, that goes a certain depth into the Earth, as deep as we actually find living things. And it also goes above the surface in the air as far as we find living things. So there's living things in the air as well. All right, that's the hierarchy. Now let's look at some cells. This is slide 10. This slide shows you two cells because there is a dichotomy or a two-part way of thinking when it comes to cells. There's two types of cells overall, and those are prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. Now, the karyo part of each of these words, which comes from a root karyon, that means kernel or core. In the case of a cell, the core that karyon refers to is what's called the cell nucleus. But not all cells have a nucleus. The prefix EU, pronounced U as in eukaryote, eukaryotic, that means true. So eukaryotic literally means having a true nucleus. Whereas pro means before. prokaryotic cells don't have a true nucleus. They came into existence in evolutionary history before the nucleus came into existence. So that's the dichotomy. You have prokaryotic cells and you have eukaryotic cells. And organisms that are made out of eukaryotic cells are called eukaryotes. Whereas an organism that has a prokaryotic cell is called a prokaryote. That's worthless. Prokaryote and eukaryote. We are eukaryotes. In general, eukaryotic cells, the ones that have a nucleus, are about 10 times bigger than prokaryotic cells in all three dimensions. So they're 10 times as wide, 10 times as long, 10 times as tall. And therefore, when you multiply 10 by 10 by 10, you get 1,000, right? They're 1,000 times the volume of a eukaryotic cell, of a prokaryotic cell. All right, well, what really qualifies a true nucleus, which is this purple thing in the middle of the eukaryotic cell, a nucleus is a true nucleus if it is surrounded by its own membrane. That membrane is called the nuclear envelope. All right? Now, any cell, prokaryotic or eukaryotic, is surrounded by its own major membrane that defines the cell itself. That outer membrane between the cell and the rest of the universe is the plasma membrane. Some books call it the cell membrane. They mean the same exact thing. Every cell has a plasma membrane, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic. But eukaryotic cells have additional membranes that make up what we call membrane-bounded organelles. And the nucleus is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. Prokaryotic cells don't have that. All multicellular organisms are eukaryotic. That includes us. But there are some eukaryotic organisms that are unicellular. So it's possible for there to be a eukaryotic cell that is an entire organism. Most eukaryotic organisms, though, have multiple cells. All prokaryotic organisms are unicellular. There aren't any multicellular prokaryotes. Okay? So keep those in mind as we go through the semester. I think slide 11 is probably where I want to stop on this part of the slideshow. What time do we get out? 10:30 if we go straight through, right? Okay. All right. Now I'm going to actually stop this recording.